One would expect the producers of this program to celebrate its 100th podcast, to bust out the birthday cake, hire a stripper, or at least throw a halfway decent party. Well, we'd love to, but Mr. Segundo has left town. He declines to be part of this podcast because he just doesn't meditate. So we'll cut straight to the chase. Without further ado, Mr. David Lynch.
So I am here with David Lynch. Most recently, he is the author of Catching the Big Fish, and he's also a filmmaker, I do believe. David, how are you doing today?
Good, Ed. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
Good.
First off, I want to talk about transcendental meditation. Specifically, you kind of identified the saying, true happiness lies within, as kind of one of the kick-starting points for you to actually get into this.
Right.
And I'm wondering, this is kind of a precept that you can also find outside transcendental meditation, so why TM over something else?
Well, it's a precept that in people's minds you can find outside of it, and we do find happiness outside, but what we notice as human beings is that happiness out there, because we live in a world of change, that happiness begins to change and it fades and then it goes. And then we look for happiness in another place and another place. And it's that kind of thing. We do find happiness, but it doesn't stay. And so this true happiness that they talk about coming from within can build up and build up and build up, and it doesn't go away. And so that's the thing that gets me, is that we as human beings have this built-in thing to dive within and experience that deepest level, pure bliss consciousness. This level has so many names, and it's real. It's a real level, and it's accessible to human beings. So any method that could get you there first time, every time, is, you know, a good meditation. But I always say, if it wasn't for transcendental meditation, I don't know what other form I would pick. Because I've heard that concentration methods of meditation keep you on the surface. Contemplation keeps you on the surface. There's a thing called mindfulness, where you kind of always try to remember the self. And this, in my book, divides the mind. You can't just, you know, arbitrarily be doing your work and try to think of the self all the time. It's a nice idea, but the true self, the bliss consciousness, intelligence, creativity that lies at the source of everything, known in Vedic science as Atma, the self, you can experience that easily and effortlessly, and unfold that and gain more and more of it. And then it's no problem remembering the self in anything you do, because that grows to the point where it's like all time reality. And then you are that. And then you go about your business, but you're always with the self. It's so beautiful. And so for me, it seems like common sense thing to learn this technique and learn to dive within and to stay at it. Go about your business and add that to your life.
You've been a TM practitioner now for 33 years. You've also been a filmmaker for 33 years. Do you think that you could have made these films without TM? Or
there's a thing I think about. It's like the events of our life will be the same. Maybe be the same, by and large, but how we go through those events will most definitely change. What used to kill us, you know, the stress and anxiety and fear of a thing, the horror of a thing, what used to be just devastating, now that power gets less and less and less, you know. It's not like we become numb to it. It's just when the inner gets glowing more and more, you can't get hurt so bad by the negative. And on the other hand, the positives you enjoy, but in a different way. You enjoy those things for sure, real enjoyment. But at the same time, a big success can kill you as bad as a failure, because you're all caught up in it and your ego is all roaring with it. And And then you see that you're at the edge of a cliff and you could take the fall. There's so much fear of holding on, maybe fear to do something else new because you're riding that high and you don't want to risk it. All kinds of complications come in with success. All kinds of complications come in with failure. But if you're building up that light from within, you can really do what you want to do. And without that add-on of fear and anxiety and, you know, all the stuff that comes with it. So much pressure in the world, so much pressure in the film business, it'll get you and it'll cramp your creative flow. And there's another expression, keep your eye on the donut and not on the hole. Easier said than done. You want to do your work, you want to enjoy the doing, but you can't just pretend that. But when this stuff comes up from the inside, and it just is that way. And then those other things that used to get you, they don't have that power on you. And another thing, you can still get angry, but you can't hold the anger. Sometimes maybe anger is necessary. You get angry, but it won't hold on to you and poison you, and it won't poison the environment. You know, no one likes to be around an angry person. Or as someone who's always depressed or always sorrowful. And now that stuff starts lifting. The side effect for enlivening unity is negativity begins to recede. Right from the very beginning, you experience that deepest level, negativity starts to recede.
But you also are referencing here this sort of anger that is kind of, at least it doesn't actually inhabit your complete being. It's sort of at least there for you to kind of purge through meditation then.
Yes, well, you don't even have to try to purge it. It's like the analogy is, on the darkest of nights, you don't have to worry about that darkness. When the sun comes up, without even trying, darkness goes. Same thing, ramp up that light of unity without even worrying about it. Negativity starts to recede from you. It doesn't have that same hold, and you get this freedom.
Is filmmaking for you, going into this notion of meditation, is filmmaking to some degree a form of meditation for you, or sort
no.
of an extra sort of aspect of expression here? Because
no, because meditation is, for me, that technique, that meditation that allows you to go within. And so when you're meditating, you're having that experience of transcending, coming back out, then going back down again, going back to the mantra, going back down, transcending. Then you go about your business. So you could say that there might be some qualities to some scenes or something that could be, you know, could kind of get you, you know, into some place. But you're not going to, you know, transcend in a film. Yeah. And you might get down deep. And so filmmaking is like a thing that I just love to do. Other people have things they just love to do. But like, even if you have a job that you don't love and you have to do it for money, if you start ramping up that light of unity inside, even the most mundane things take on this kind of wondrous thing where you start to getting even ideas to improve that and start enjoying you know the doing of that mundane job. It's weird, and so like you can get this inner happiness going, and what happens is understanding starts growing and appreciation starts growing. So you kind of get a deeper understanding of what's going on and an appreciation for things. It's just like, you know, you just start appreciating things. And it may have been something that just drove you nuts before. But now suddenly it's all like a game. It's all beautiful. People that used to drive you nuts, you sort of start seeing them in a different light. And they're human beings, and you sort of kind of love them.
Mm-hmm. But simultaneously, I'm wondering if people can find this sort of state of transcendence or this unity of light outside of TM or doing another thing. Like for me, I go for like a long walk and sometimes I see a bright light in my own sort of metaphorical kind of way.
Okay, now let's say like you could go on a walk.
Yeah.
I only can say that, you know, people have transcended and not knowing how they got there. Everyone has a certain amount of consciousness, and we all appreciate waking, sleeping, and dreaming. When you pass from waking to sleeping, they say that you go through a gap. Waking state of consciousness goes to sleeping state of consciousness, and in the transition, the gap, you can transcend. And so many people have experienced that. Going to sleep, they'll be almost asleep, and bango, bright light and a kind of a bliss, you know, a real happiness comes over. And then they say, whoa, what is that? And it's an experience. If you were you know, more lively in your sleep, you would get that same opportunity going to dreaming state of consciousness and dreaming back to sleep, sleep to waking. But it's something that happens by chance, whereas you take a technique that's built for that ancient technique of transcendental meditation, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi brings it back now. Vedic technology for transcendence, and you take that, and it's guaranteed every time you're going to transcend, every time. And so a lot of people think, oh, my kind of meditation is jogging, my kind of meditation is laying on the beach, my kind of meditation is this. But if you could have that experience of, you know, really getting to that deepest level, which is such a blessing, to get the key to open that door is huge. Then you'd have it all the time, and you'd be growing in that. And then you would appreciate the walks. And then you'd say, oh, I thought it was walking was doing it, but it wasn't. But now I even appreciate my walks more.
I see.
Like that kind of thing.
But perhaps some people can, in their own kind of way, meditate through outside TM.
Yes. There's many forms and transcend.
Yeah.
I've heard stories. You know, I don't know of another one. Now, there's the reason is we're talking in the abstract, but there's brain research going on now where they test different forms of meditation on the EEG machine and other kind of things. Now, it's interesting. Concentration, type of meditation that's concentration on the EEG machine, we use different parts of our brain for different things. So they're concentrating. The part of the brain that deals with concentration gets huge. But no transcending. When someone is practicing transcendental meditation on the EEG machine and they transcend, entire brain lights up. The entire brain. It's a holistic experience. It's the unified field. It's oneness. Holistic. So you see the whole brain get engaged. It's the only experience, Ed, that lights the full brain. So now with brain research, people can go in and see if they are getting, if they're transcending. Transcending is the key. If another form of meditation did it, beautiful. Beautiful. And as so many of these meditations, people say, well, I practiced this form of meditation and it was just so hard and so difficult and I finally gave it up. You know, it was hard work trying. Transcendental meditation, on the other hand, is effortless. Supremely profound, but effortless. Why is it effortless? The mantra turns the mind within, so it's aimed within, and it's effortless and natural because each deeper level of mind, each deeper level of intellect has more happiness, more charm. So you just dive. You want to go. The human being always wants to go to a field of greater happiness. And the analogy for that is you're in a classroom, drudgery work in the classroom, and beautiful music starts playing. And your mind will just go to that without trying. So here's the dive within, more and more happiness, and then the ultimate happiness, the ocean of pure bliss consciousness. And you hit that. The splash of that is bliss. The experiencing of that enlivens it. It starts to grow. And you grow in consciousness, and you grow in all those positive values of that field.
But in terms of this effortless dive that you describe, isn't this entirely up to like an individual? Maybe some individual might find something like TM to be more their cup of tea, or not just a cup of tea, but a way for them to find this bliss that is a cup of tea that lasts all day long. But then other people might find a sort of transcendence through, you know, as I sort of suggested, walking or, you know, seeing the funny side of life and not being so angry or just like letting someone who is bad get to them.
I understand what you're saying, Ed. Yeah. And I hate to see people thinking that they're getting transcendence. Let's say we all knew really what that feeling was, that experience was, because when I first transcended in my first meditation, I said, "Holy jumping George, this is a unique and powerful experience that I have not had. And where has this experience been?" It was mind-bogglingly beautiful. So it would be sad if a person thought by walking I'm transcending, and later after years of walking thinking they were, you know, evolving very rapidly, finding out that no, I was enjoying my walk, but I wasn't experiencing that deepest level of life. So it hurts me, you know. But maybe I you know, if you could hook it with brain research or things like that, you could be walking with the thing. Now you can strap these things on and move about. You could
strap what things on?
The
exactly.
EEG machine.
Oh, the EEG, okay.
And see what your brain was doing during that walk. There's enjoyment there for sure, and there's nature, and there's all this beauty and everything like that. And maybe you're a highly evolved human being, and you've got so much consciousness that you're carrying so much of the transcendent with you. And you know, it's anything is possible. But what I'm trying to say is, it is a unique, powerful experience. And when you experience it, you enliven it and you grow consciousness. So it's important to, you know, to know what your meditation is really giving you. And it's so, like, anyone that would give you that deepest thing is so important for the human being.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's tie this into how this affects your sort of creative consciousness. I was particularly interested in what you had to say about fear and anxieties and how understanding these is not necessarily, you don't have to actually suffer. You don't actually have to experience or sort of submerge yourself in fear and anxiety to produce art. But simultaneously, I would also counter-argue that there was a great Nobel Prize-winning author named Knut Hamsun. He experienced this incredible poverty, and he wrote this fantastic book called Hunger. I'm not sure if you've heard of it, but it was this prototype for a lot of the noir books that came in the 20th century. And while perhaps he didn't actually write this in entire poverty, or he sort of submerged this out of him, he's nevertheless had that personal experience to draw from. How do you sort of understand fear and anxiety in your work? Do you have this kind of personal experience in the past of fear and anxiety to understand it? Maybe you can kind of talk about this, because I really was, it was a very interesting one of the things you said, you know?
Yeah. When, you know, the whole ball of wax exists, and this field that you transcend into is a field of all-knowingness. It's all-knowingness, total knowledge there in that field. It's the knowledge and creativity, intelligence that creates the universe and universes. Vedic science, the science of consciousness, always said that. But now quantum physics is validating that with each new advance. Quantum physics discovers the unified field at the base of all matter. Anything that is a thing, they say, emerges from that field.
We're talking about Einstein's theory of everything.
Well, yeah, but it was Einstein what died before they actually, you know, discovered the unified field, the Lagrangian of the superstring. And there's quantum physicists that, you know, would argue with, you know, what I'm saying. But I travel with a great quantum physicist named Dr. John Haglin, who could sit and talk to any quantum physicist, and pretty soon I think they'd be seeing eye to eye. It's so abstract. Yeah. But you can experience that field. I'm just saying, you can experience it. It's there. And so now let me talk about suffering.
Sure.
You know, there's, like in movies, people die. So you say, well, you don't have to die to show a death, you know. And there's all kinds of suffering and torment and all these things in a story. And for me, those things come from ideas. Now, when you catch an idea, you see the thing. You hear the thing. you feel and see and hear the mood of it, and you see the character. You almost see what the character wears, and you see what the character says and how they say it. It's an idea that comes all at once, and you know that idea. Now, so I'm real interested in ideas. And then you see on some ideas that you fall in love with, you fall in love with twice, because the next time you fall in love is you see what cinema could do to that in translating that idea. It's so beautiful. Now, if you were able to expand understanding and appreciation, you'd understand the human condition more, and you'd appreciate it more, and you'd get that knowingness, that intuition going more. So when it wasn't correct, you'd feel it wasn't correct. It's so delicate. And when you feel it isn't correct, you also can see a way to make it be correct. Very beautiful, kind of critical things. And it's, so it's like a knowing as you translate the idea. And then, you know, there's coming with that idea is a kind of an understanding of why that person is suffering, how they manifest that suffering, and what is happening in this story, and you just understand it. And there's so many things in films that the filmmaker hasn't experienced, but the people know it's a human thing, and you just know those things. But like I say in the book, the artist doesn't have to suffer to show suffering. And you know, and then this guy who wrote Hunger, or like Vincent van Gogh, they always artists, and I was that, I mean, I don't want to, I'm in love with the idea of the art life, you know, and it's like the business life, you know, is just, you know, repellent to me, you know what I mean? The art life is like, it goes with the thing that's ingrained, you know, from the past. You know, like a garret, not a lot of, you know, money, and kind of, you know, small amounts of bad food, smoking and coffee, and working.
Yeah.
But I say that most of that, and a kind of anti-hero kind of, not kind of like a victim almost of the society, and you create, and you, but it's mostly to get chicks, I think. That's why I say, and it's so romantic, but if you stop for 1 second and you see what suffering can do, real suffering, like say the artist falls into a depression, and like Diane Arbus fell into depressions, and she didn't feel like taking pictures then, and it stops that creative flow. Real anger, honest to goodness anger, it's got, the mind is so filled with it, how can you create? All the negativity does is squeeze that conduit of the flow of creativity, ideas, the joy of doing. And if that lifts, you can really do stuff. Now, artists like to have an edge. And they think, well, if I meditate, and I thought this, if I meditate, I'm going to lose that edge, that power. No, you're going to get more energy, more clarity, more ability to focus. You're going to become, you know, your edge is going to get mighty and sharp. And when you really believe in something, what is it? It's just like that power that makes it happen is going to grow. And you're not going to be like everybody else, you know. You're going to be more and more you. You don't have to worry about it. But you'll just be way more powerfully you. And the negativity that you have, if any, you know, and everybody's got, you know, a bunch of stuff in them, this is going to start lifting. And then you're going to enjoy working so much more. And you're going to be, you know, so filled with ideas and inspiration and energy. And it's just so good for the art life. It's like, and it's not a goofball happiness. It's just a solid becoming more and more you. Your voice getting shiny and louder and louder.
I'm with you when it comes to sort of having a more holistic approach to life and being able to think about anything or write, or in your case, make films with just about every kind of emotion, no matter what sort of situation you're in. But isn't there something to be said also about kind of just deadlines in the face? I mean, you know, Dostoevsky, in 1866, he had these huge gambling debts. And basically his publisher said, okay, I'll go ahead and pay for your gambling debts, but you have to give me all of these books by a crazy deadline. And what did he do? Not only does he turn out The Gambler, a few other books, but he also turns out Crime and Punishment, which is now universally acknowledged as a literary classic. Isn't there something to be said for just having a really kind of crazy conditions like this that the artist can produce despite the fact that there's this... Because you wrote in this book, if you have enough stress, you won't be able to create. And so this is why I bring this up, because Dostoevsky clearly created in this condition.
There's stress. There's just the way we understand that word. Stress, you know, can make you sick. Stress related illness can make you sick. Motivation is a different thing, and sometimes we need a kick in the butt to get rolling. Now Dostoevsky, he got motivated, but he had those ideas. And it started flowing, and maybe that's what he needed to do to get that those things. You know, otherwise sometimes you just get complacent and you don't really work. You're thinking and dreaming and stuff like this. And this is like a thing. Somebody else could get that same offer, and then start going, and it just like I it's like and fall apart.
Yeah.
So it doesn't. One thing doesn't mean the same thing for everybody. And people do know that stress and anxiety and this is like takes you, away from that flow. It just takes you away. It's not a happy thing. And the kids are getting, they say, stress at a younger and younger age. There's so much pressure. We hear about things going on everywhere, and we begin to worry, and we get pressure, and we get this and this and this, and people start bringing guns to school and drugs to school, and it's not fun to go to school. It's frightening to go to school, and there's all kinds of cliques, and people don't get along, and they don't listen to their teacher, and they got lots of homework, and it's kind of like a nightmare to do what? Get facts and figures, try to get into a good school. What if you don't get in a good school? You feel like a total failure. Your life is over. You get in a good school for what? To get a job. And more stress, more stress, more stress. That's our lives going by. We got to, it's so beautiful to enjoy life. You give meditation to kids, and from inside, they light up. The fear goes, and the stress goes, like water off a duck's back. They become self-assured, strong. They start liking their fellow students. They start listening to the teacher. Their grades go up. There's happiness more in the home. Happiness more, they get so strong that they'll go do what they truly want to do, regardless of money or pressures of this. They just get a knowingness of what they really, want to do, and they don't have a problem with, this other baloney. And you don't worry about those kids. And that's the thing. And it builds up from the inside, and no one can take it away from you. And it transforms your life.
One final question, because I know we have to get wrapped up for being flagged, but I wanted to actually ask you about... There's also the sort of spontaneous nature of creating art. You write again about the famous moment where your set dresser, Frank Silva, became Bob simply because you saw his reflection in a mirror. But it also makes me wonder, like, I was fortunate enough to see Inland Empire before I actually talked to you. There are very specific sort of moments sometimes in your films, like, for example, the knife being dropped onto the star of Dorothy L'Amour. Now, part of me sort of says, is that deliberate, or is that sort of along the lines of, like, you saw the Dorothy L'Amour star and you said, hey, this is just looks really good to me. How much of this is a matter of instinct? But you also mentioned the key and the box in Mulholland Drive in this book. You don't know what it means. So maybe you can answer some of these sorts of issues.
No, I can't, Ed. that was sort of a joke, that answer in the book. Yeah. And it stayed in as a... a short chapter.
Yeah.
And then where a thing falls, it's the beautiful thing about human beings. They'll read into something when in fact there's that's just where it fell. And so it's Hollywood Boulevard, and there's many, many stars, and that's where this scene took place. So, but ideas are the thing, and they can come at any moment. And the story about Frank is one example. So, hearing that girl say, "Don't lock yourself in that room," started a thing. And that thing grew, you know, in time. More ideas came in. And this process is something that's just like, you know, it's the creative process. Yeah. And it takes ideas. Those are thoughts. Where do those things come from? They bubble up from the deepest level. And where we catch them just depends on our ball of consciousness. So if you could expand that, you can catch them at a deeper level, more to them. Deeper, maybe some profoundly big ideas. And, you know, so it's like they can come at any time. There's no one kind of, you know, formula, but I equate it to fishing, because you have a desire for a fish that starts the process, a desire. Then you have the bait is that desire. You lower it in, and patience, you know, fishing requires some patience. And so, and it's a focus. While you're sitting, you're kind of like willing a fish in. You're focusing and desiring. And one moment, one day, bingo, you've got one. Beautiful, beautiful day. You catch an idea that you fall in love with. And that process, for me, gets more fun and more often ability to catch those ideas. And intuit a thing, understand a thing, to get it to feel correct, and it's like that's the ticket.
Do you ever fully understand your films?
Yes, you have to. Well, here's the thing: fully is the word.
Yeah.
But I say it's sort of like this: you understand it, you have to understand it to do it. But it might be that I understand the fundamental notes. But if you get those fundamental notes correct, then the harmonics, the higher harmonics, will also be correct. And I might not know about those higher harmonics, but someone else, some viewer, may catch a higher meaning. I may see it 10 years later and catch a higher thing. I say, gee, I didn't know. But if you're true to the idea, really true, even if they're just the fundamental, but that's big.
Yeah.
Know the fundamentals, get those to be correct, then who knows what the harmonics will bring to people, you know, or you in time.
David Lynch, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, pal.
Thanks a lot.